This is the next in the series of interviews done with local immigrants at the Cedar Mill Community Library. This interview is with Jim Sagawa, so sit back and enjoy his stories.
Hello, my name is Mark Richardson, and I'm here with Jim. Jim's going to tell us a little bit about his story. So, Jim, why don't you go ahead and tell us your name?
My name is Jim Sagawa. My father, Masa Ichiro, and my mother, Kazuno Sagawa, immigrated from Japan in 1919, hit the port of Seattle in 1919. Dad farmed in an area close to Seattle, farmed potatoes, made it big, invested it all back against the advice of other farmers, back into potatoes again. I think he lost everything. Migrated down to Oregon and decided to go west of the Willamette River and ended up in Hillsboro, Oregon with mom and dad. They had kind of a pop and mom grocery fruit stand. They had seven children. Dad died when I was born in Hillsboro, Oregon, and I believe my sister Helen was born in. The rest of the brothers and sisters were born up in Seattle in the Washington area. I was born in Jones Hospital, and then when I was one, Dad died. So that left Mom with a brood of seven kids to raise, age from 1 to 14. And I don't know how she did it, Mark, because she really didn't speak the language. You know, she had to rely mostly on the kids. But somehow the tough old lady was able to raise us, not in the most lavish ways, but we survived. We ate in 1940, probably about the early 40s. Mom moved the operation into Portland, in Northwest Portland, where she opened up another grocery store. It was right across from Montgomery Ward, and then I think the Nato brothers changed it to some kind of a name and. But that's where we lived until the outbreak of World War II.
Okay.
Yeah, when December 7th arrived, that affected everybody was affected. I think all of these Issei, which would be the first generation, I am a second generation Japanese American, and I feel like the Issei were very docile people. You know, they really had no, well, really roots to, you know, fight back. And so, February 19th, 1942, President Roosevelt issued a proclamation, 9066, stating that the military could do anything what they wanted with the Japanese American and Japanese of descent. And they were, all of the Japanese Americans were removed 200 miles inland from the coast of the Pacific Ocean, figuring that maybe we would be detrimental to the safety of the United States, which it never happened. 1942, my brother Henry was... Well, during this time, you know, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, anything pertaining to whether you owned that relate you to Japan was destroyed, such as I was telling you before that it just killed me when Mom destroyed this picture of Dad, who was mounted on a white steed, a horse, with his military uniform, with a sword, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was just a shame, because it was a handsome picture.
So when you say things were destroyed, so the families themselves destroyed things just so the other folks living around them would think that they were loyal to the U.S. instead of Japan?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And then when that happened, you know, the FBI, without any search warrants, or would walk into a home of yours, ransack, going through whatever they were looking for, and then leave. You know, and this happened to two of my good friends. You know, their families. They came in, and the FBI just rifled through drawers, everything. Just I don't know what they were looking for. So in April of 42, people of Japanese descent, Japanese Americans, were given the were notified that in so many days they had to uproot, get rid of all their possessions, and be interned in the assembly center, which was the Portland International Livestock Pavilion at that time. Now it's known as a Portland Expo Center. This was an area where they showed horses, cows, pigs, etc. And so to house, let's see, there were, I would say, about 3,500 to 4,000 people from Washington and Oregon that were put into this assembly center, they called it. And that covered 11 acres, and this livestock pavilion was boarded over. I'm sure the manure was removed, but the smell was still there. And these were made into various size cubicles to house 3,500 to 4,000 people. The main arena was boarded over, and that was made into kind of like a gym so the young men could play athletics.
And about how old were you at this time?
I was 10 years old. I was 10 years old. So I'm saying this from the standpoint of a kid that's 10 years old and what I can remember, what I've been told, and this type of thing. But I do remember it was a hot summer. I remember. And it was, and I do remember the smell, you know, that you couldn't help but detect smell over, you know, animal feces that was removed, but still the remnants of odor were still there. In your cubicle, if you had a family of five, you had five cots. And that's about all you could put into those cubicles. The door was a canvas, piece of canvas that was used as a door. There was no ceiling. It was partitioned off with plywood. And like I told you before, somebody burped down five, you know, you could hear the burp all the way up here. The feeding or the food was not the most gourmet. Much tongue, much liver, much heart. But they did have rice, which they did have rice. And I believe they ate in shifts of 2,000, I think, or 1,500. And that was the way you ate. I do remember along the mess hall there were these flypaper strips, and they were black with flies, you know. It couldn't be helped. As far as hygiene, the toilets, showers were not private. There were no partitions between showers, no partition between toilets. So men, it was all right, you know, and boys, it would be fine. But the women, that was kind of a harsh blow to them. And embarrassment, I'm sure. As far as entertainment, the young men played baseball out there. They'd have enough room to have a baseball diamond. And I can remember just kind of tagging along these athletes because I loved sports, and I'd follow them around like a dog. So I kind of became their mascot, these guys. Yeah. Covered 11 acres, which was barbed-wired in. And there were four guard tiles at the corners. Guns were not pointed out, but pointed in, figuring that, you know, going to be an escape or something, which nobody ever did. Right. So they did have various departments, like fire department and police department and athletic department. They had those. And that summer, being a very hot summer, the fire department thought, well, they'd hose down the floors to cool off everybody, but of course the water seeped down through the floor, and then the smell of the increased the intensity of the smell. When you entered the assembly center, you could only bring what you could carry. So if you were to think now, what's the most important things that we have to take, you know, it would quite be a decision. It really would, because nowadays it would be laptops. And September, that was May of 42, so we stayed there May, June, July, August. September is when we were put on trains, blinds were pulled, and they took us to Twin Falls, Idaho, where we got on trucks, and they took us to Minidoka, while we're in the Portland Expo Center, ten camps were being constructed. And these barracks, I'll call them, were just constructed of plywood, tar paper, and a slat to keep the tar paper up there. So these camps were always built in areas that were very desolate, you know, mostly sagebrush country where we'd be out of the way. So we went to a place called Minidoka, Idaho, which I believe was about 9,500 of us were in this camp here. There were 44 blocks. Each block contained 6 barracks. Down the center, if you can picture it, down the center was the area of bathing, washing clothes. And if I remember right, every other block had the mess hall. I don't think every block had a mess hall. And again, there was no privacy there was no partitions between toilets or showers. Being that they put these camps in the most desolate spot, like ours was a lot of sagebrush, and when those were removed, it was summer was dusty, hot, wintertime was muddy, cold, very cold. Each of the barracks had each little, I'll call them apartments. There were 6 apartments in each barrack, 12 barracks to a block. And to keep warm, they had a pot-bellied stove in the middle, and you fed it with coal, I believe. And again, there was no real furniture, but if you had 4 in the family, there were 4 cots, and I think just a light bulb in the middle. So in Minidoka, of course, then being a guy 10 years old, kid 10 years old, did a lot of playing. And summertime, there was a canal that went through our area, and very dangerous canal, really, because it was used for irrigation of crops, the farmers would. And like, gosh, what was I? About a 5th grader, and I knew how to swim, thank goodness. But if you got in the canal and started one area and down 30 yards, you'd be finally make it across. And then I remember getting potatoes from Farmer Brown there and putting it in our swimsuit and then swimming back and and then putting in the fire and having baked potatoes. And then in the wintertime, it was being so cold that many of these areas would freeze over so you could ice skate. And you bought your clothes through Sears and Roebuck and Montgomery Ward's catalogs, so many kids bought ice skates through the catalog, and so there was ice skating done on the waters there. I think my brother Henry sent me a pair from the Army when he was in the Army. And so in camp, there was George and I, Mom, Helen, and then Ikey got drafted out of the camp, put in the Army, and so there were just 4 of us. And then Mom became very, very ill, needed better, more expertise in the field of medicine. So a Reverend Johnson from Boise, Idaho, sponsored our family, rented us a home, and kind of overlooked to see that everything was fine with us. So there was Mom, and that was probably October of 1943, so I was only in there just about a year.
Okay.
So then we moved to Boise, Idaho, under the care of Mr. Johnson, and Mom was taken into the hospital right away, and then she was opened up, and then cancer had riddled her whole body, so they closed her up, and then she passed away right away in December of 43. So there left George, Helen, and me, and George was 22. So he was kind of the guardian. He was left to, not taken in the Army, but he was left to take care of Helen and I, who was 3 years older than I. Somehow we managed to live, and George worked for the Waihe Hotel as a bellhop. My brother Henry in the service would send money home to help out and everything. But somehow it didn't end up in jail. I don't know how we existed, but we did. Helen must have been 14, so she had to do the cooking and the cleaning and washing. And then, I remember for my allowance of 25 cents, I always had to bring in the coal, the kindling, and help with the dishes. I remember that.
And so you guys settled in Boise for a little while?
For 43, and then I was very fortunate to get into a neighborhood of about radius of four blocks. There were many kids my age and older, and we did a lot of bicycle riding, swimming together, baseball, football, and I can still hear them outside. Okay, Jim, we're ready to go. I got to do my dishes, and then we go down to the greens and play football. People of Boise, Mark, were very nice. The parents of these kids were got to have a very fond memory of them. There were the Fraziers, the Coomlers, and, you know, just people that treated me like a son, except for one kid named Lefty Reynolds that said, don't come around the house, Jim, because Dad doesn't like Japanese. In Boise, like I told you, there were signs that said, no Japs allowed, no Japs allowed, no Japs allowed at restaurants. But somehow we managed, and you just stayed away from those places. After the war, Henry was discharged and Ike was discharged. Boys had no formal education. They finished high school, of course, but they didn't have any vocations. So I think my brother Henry had raised strawberries, 5 acres of strawberries prior to going, you know, the war. And so on Laidlaw Road, there were the Hamels. There was Bill Hamel, which rented Henry the boys 32 acres of land, and they had no money, so they used Farmer Bill's horses to do the working up of the ground, you know, the plowing, the harrowing, the disking.
So did they know that family from before when you guys were in the area? Or?
You know, I don't think so. I don't know how they ever came across Bill. And remember, we had a Model A for transportation, and I think they bought an old used army truck for hauling pickers in, and then when the pickers were taken home, then we hauled the berries into Birdseye Cannery in Hillsboro. And I remember as I got older, I did many trips of hauling strawberries into Birdseye Cannery, and I can remember walking behind old Brownie cultivating, you know, walked many, many miles behind Brownie. So that was, that's how they got started. And then I entered, my sister Hanlon graduated from Beaverton High in 47. That's when I entered Beaverton High. The war ended in 45. So there, you know, there's still that feeling of anti-Japanese. But in the high school, of Beaverton High School of maybe 600, 650 at the time I entered, there were no other Black, Filipino, Chinese, Japanese, no other ethnic group was really, because now if you were to go into a school, it's just riddled with Asians and Blacks, which is good, which is a good mixing. I think I was lucky because I played sports. I played all three of them. I played football, basketball, and baseball at Beaverton High. And that's when, you know, a small guy could play, you know. Yeah. Now you get killed or you get the ball shoved down your face. And then I was lucky enough to get a scholarship, football scholarship to Lewis and Clark, where I started my education. Did not do well, Mark. In fact, very poor. And I played under a coach named Joe Houston and a guy named Al Aiken. And halfway through my sophomore year, I said, I better get out of there. I'm not doing well. I don't want any flunks on my record. So I quit, withdrew. And then there are four of us guys from Beaverton High School that probably did the same thing, not very serious about school. They went to Pacific U on a basketball and football scholarship. So we put our name up on the draft. And within 30 days, we were in the Army.
Yeah.
And I trained up at Fort Lewis, Washington during a real June. Finished 4 months of basic training up there. And my good friend, Dick Wise, said, let's go airborne. I said, no way am I jumping out of airplanes. I'll take my chance. Korean War was going hot and heavy at the time, but I said, I'll take my chances going to Korea. But the orders came out when we finished basic training, and those that fooled around and goofed off and got reprimanded were sent to Korea. The rest of us went to Germany, which was good duty, and Dick went to airborne, and I was very fortunate when I got hit Germany, Bremerhaven, and then down to Zweibrücken, which was a replacement depot, and there they interviewed you as to if you're going to be a cook, or you're going to be a truck driver, or you're going to be in the office, mm-hmm. and the interviewer was a sergeant who said, you know, Jim, we need another Asian on post. I mean, they must have had allotments of blacks, Asian, at that time. He said, yeah, would you like to interview? And I said, you darn right, I would. I was a walking soldier when I hit over. And so the interviewer was a captain from Lake Oswego.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we had a nice long talk about Lake Oswego, Oregon, and they told him how I used to come over and swim in the lake. At that time, you could do that. And so I was in classification and assignment, and it was good duty. It was kind of like on a college campus when I would say 80% of the troops that came to Europe came through our depot, and then we classified them, and I took care of their records, made sure that 10 guys going to Heidelberg had their records with them, and made sure that they were with them when they got to Heidelberg. Again, I played sports there at the base there, but it was a small base, so I could play. When you're thrown in with guys from Missouri, New York, Louisiana, and you're together for so long, you really develop strong friendships. And to this day, I still keep in contact with 7 of them yet, you know? And two have come over and stayed with us, and we stayed over there in New York with a fellow. And a couple of them have passed away. And to think, you know, these guys that we, you know, kind of carouse around in Germany, over in Germany, you know, a lot of tipping the bottle. And but they all turned out pretty darn good. So then 1955, and when I was over in Europe, I did travel. I did travel as much as money I could gather, and I think I wired home once to my brother Henry if I could have $50. I had a trip planned, you know. As soon as I could get enough time off from the base, you know, I ended up in... if I was 55, February 55, I was bitter because I had to spend one extra day in the Army because it was a weekend and they wouldn't release us. So I spent 2 years, one day in the Army, and came out, went to Oregon State University and studied my head off because I didn't know if I had it in me to do it. And I graduated in 1958 from Oregon State University, or college at that time, and then applied for dental school and was accepted to dental school in 58, finished in 1962, and I practiced in Beaverton for about 32 years.
Oh, okay.
So I feel like I'm a very, very lucky man, you know. And like I tell the kids when I go to the school, I say, you know, if you set your goals high, you know, study hard, you can attain whatever you really want to do.
Yeah,
I don't know if it gets into their heads, but...
yeah, well, I'm sure like you, they have to...
yeah, you're right. but...
struggle a little bit maybe before they...
And I had a nice practice. I loved my patients. But when I was done after 32 years, I divorced dentistry and...
So when you toured Europe when you were in the... military, what were the differences then from when you went back?
Well,
this
time? Yeah, lodging was much different. Food was much different. I mean, we kind of now get a little bit of a few-star hotels, you know, and the food much better. Traveling, you know, everything is taken care of. And much nicer.
Yeah. I imagine there must have been a lot of destruction.
You know, You know, when we went to, I was fortunate to get a weekend pass, and we went to Berlin. And then you had to get a special pass to go into Eastern Berlin, because remember that was broken off into four sectors. And the West sector, the U.S. side of it, they were pretty much getting built up. East sector, the Russian side, was really demolished yet. It was really, the destruction was still there. You were advised not to take pictures of the Russian soldiers, so you kind of had the Russian soldiers in your background, you know, right, when you took a picture.
One thing occurred to me when you were talking about your mom and the young kids, taking care of you by herself. Was there a big Japanese community that was here at the time that helped with?
And I don't recall that, not that much.
You guys pretty isolated?
Pretty much Hillsborough. Oh, there were families that helped, of course. And that I don't remember much about, you know. It's a shame, you know, because they died so young. And there's no question, you know, what, right, you know. And I feel bad because, you know, I've been back to Japan. And one time, Amy, my wife's parents, said, I'll be your tour guide. And so he set up the whole trip. But I said, I want to go back to where, you know, Dad and Mom were, came from. And so we found relatives, first cousins, who were women. One looked pretty much like my sister, you know, one of my older sisters. And they married well. They married well. The ones in Tokushima, her husband owned a fleet of cargo ships.
Oh, wow.
And the other woman, her family owned a lot of land in Tokushima, the island of Shikoku, where they came from.
Do you have any idea why your parents came over?
Well, I think to make a living. I think I've been told that the firstborn male gets everything, second male gets nothing. So I think Dad came to America to try to, you know, start a new life.
Yeah.
I don't know how common it is in the U.S., but I think in Japan, if there's no heir to carry the name of Sugawa or something, the husband of the wife has nobody to carry on the name of their family, that the husband will take the name of their family. So my father's brother took the name of Ogawa and perpetuated their name, and they lived in California.
Knowing that Japan was an enemy of the U.S. during the World War II, but also Germany and Italy, but the German immigrants living here and the Italian immigrants living here obviously didn't go through the same experience that the Japanese immigrants did. Why do you think that there was such a different reaction to Japan?
Okay, for one thing, I think, you know, because of physical characteristics. You know, right, you can distinguish, you know, Asian easily. And so we were very recognizable and could be herded away. Whereas your German and your Italians, you know, they kind of melt into the right society. But I think some of them were imprisoned, I think, Germans.
Oh, really?
I think so.
I mean, one of the other interviews we've done, a woman was talking about her Hungarian mother who had immigrated over, and she would have to go let them know what she was doing every week, but they didn't put her in a camp or anything.
Oh, is that? Okay.
So it's just interesting to think about the different reactions.
You know,
I'm assuming it has to do with prejudice. You know,
oh, sure. That rang high in along the West Coast, because I think, you know, I heard of families that were very, you know, Caucasian and Japanese families intermixed, and then war broke out, enemy, you know, no association, and then you hear a lot about, you know, the Caucasian kids said, you know, I was playing with him, and then next day he's gone, you know.
Well, I think that's it for now. So thanks again for doing the interview with us.